Well, for about the last 10 or 15 years, the term of art in politics has been family values. And, of course, the family has always been important. Has it always been important in American politics, culture, social life, in the same way it is today? What about just the basic picture of the family? I grew up in what we call nowadays a large family. That was a family of five children. Two parents, five children. So seven, all said, not counting cats and dogs. Well, go back 50 years, that was a medium-sized family. Go back 100 years, that might have been considered, well, a small family, five kids. I remember as a parish pastor going back into the family register of my congregation that dated back over 160 years at the time and discovering that it was not unusual, at all unusual, for families to stretch into the teens, 13, 14. Nowadays, that is almost unheard of. Why? We're going to talk about the future, the past and the future of marriage and family in the United States here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. An issue that touches each and every one of us. Dr. Alan Carlson will be our guest. Now, coming up in about a half hour, we're going to spend some time talking about 2006 pro-life legislation in the state of Missouri. Susan Klein of Missouri Right to Life will be our guest. We're going to follow that with a little bit of a news item from Garden Grove, California, where the Crystal Cathedral still stands since 1986. One of the best known, if not the largest, best known churches in the United States and internationally. Dr. Robert Schuller has been its pastor from the very, very beginning. His son has been a co-pastor with him for quite some time. The torch, was it a crystal torch? I don't know. The torch was passed on New Year's Day. We're going to hear some of the audio from that service. And then a little bit later in the program, we'll also be reviewing the sermon that the elder Schuller gave on that occasion, reflecting on his long ministry. He's not leaving the ministry. His son has just been elected to be the next senior pastor of the Crystal Cathedral. All right, then in the second hour of the program, Pastor Matt Harrison is going to be our guest. We're going to talk with him about tsunami relief. It was more than a year ago that the tsunami struck, the day after Christmas, 2004, and a lot still remains to be done. We'll talk with Pastor Harrison about that briefly. We'll spend the better part of the rest of that second hour listening to a PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly program. They had a religion roundtable looking ahead to 2006. What will the big issues be when it comes to religion? We'll play that for you. Stop and start and do some commentary. All of that is open lines as well, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The second hour will end with a short conversation. Marianne Hackett joins us from Illinois Right to Life. We'll talk about Illinois pro-life legislation in 2006, and then the last hour is a sermon review. As I said before, Dr. Robert Schuller from the Crystal Cathedral, sermon upon the passing of the torch to his son, a senior pastor of that church out in California. We'll review the sermon in the last hour of the program. Dr. Alan Carlson is a regular guest. He's president of the Howard Center in Rockford, Illinois. He's authored several books, including Fractured Generations, Crafting a Family Policy of the 21st Century America. And he's also written an article for the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled The Family Factors. Dr. Carlson, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Are the issues surrounding the family in the 21st century, are they significantly different than they've been ever before in American history?
Actually not. Some of the issues we're dealing with today, let's say issues such as work-family conflicts, the cry for daycare, how do we protect the parent at home, how do we deal with issues of elder care, who's going to take care of the elderly? These issues have been around for at least 200 years, ever since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. You've got to remember, the Industrial Revolution, the key change that took place was that it separated, radically separated, the place a person worked from where they lived. That was something new in human history. And we've been struggling with that. I say we citizens of the modern world have been struggling with that question ever since. Another set of problems, issues of abortion, contraception, falling fertility, sexual revolution. Just about everything we're debating and worrying about and fighting about today was on the table already at least 100 years ago, around 1900. Illegal abortion was illegal, but it was widespread and growing. The contraception revolution was picking up speed. Fertility was tumbling in the United States. Prominent figures such as Theodore Roosevelt pointed to a soaring divorce rate. Out in Reno and in Las Vegas, the divorce mills, the divorce chapels were already up and running. You could get a quick, easy divorce out there. So all of these problems also are at least a century old.
Now, one thing that you write about is the so-called family wage. That sounds so odd to us today, especially in an age where it is simply assumed in society or culture, and especially by our lawmakers, that both husband and wife will be working outside the home for the majority of the family's tenure. What was the family wage, and who were the advocates of it?
Well, it is astonishing that the phrase is almost forgotten today, because I would say from at least about 1850 up until 1965, the family wage was the central pillar of the American social, political, economic system. It simply was one way of dealing with the problem I mentioned of the Industrial Revolution. You know, the factories and the offices were sucking adults and children out of the homes into the factories, and in a sense, making home life almost impossible. Men, women, and children were being sought by the new factories. Somebody had to work the machines. The family wage was an effort began in the 19th century by religious leaders, social reformers, even labor union leaders who wanted to protect the home. And the deal was this. They said, okay, we can't prevent the Industrial Revolution. We can't stop it. And a lot of good things come from it, but we can tame it. We can tame it by saying that the factory system is only going to get one family member per household, and that's normally going to be the father. He will be the breadwinner, but that means that the mother will be protected at home, and the father will earn an adequate wage to support himself, the mother, and the children. And the concept was called a family wage, a family-sustaining wage. And that became, I would say, the key goal, the key objective of American labor unions, American social reformers, even of American political leaders in the early 20th century. The New Deal was premised on giving a family wage and of encouraging the homemaking functions of women in order to protect home life and protect some independence of the home and to protect the children. But that concept, which was understood by everybody, was opposed by a few, by some early feminists and so on, by the industrial leaders. Many manufacturing factory owners didn't like it, but it was the central principle of our social system, and it was abandoned almost cavalierly about 30 years ago.
What did those who were the advocates and who considered just the idea of the family wage part and parcel of dealing with the challenges of the Industrial Revolution and its aftermath, what did they know about the security of the family and its relationship to the greater society that we have apparently forgotten in the last three decades?
Well, they have forgotten, again, I think, this fundamental challenge. They knew this fundamental challenge of the factory system to home life, and that this was the best, not a perfect way, but was the best way they could think of to tame the system so that it didn't disrupt the home entirely. They looked at other options. They looked at other possibilities. They looked at the possibility of what we now call the two-career home, where both parents are in the workforce, supplemented by daycare and so on. And they saw that it wasn't good for children, and that, in fact, it probably would decrease the desirability of having children. Maybe a couple would have one, but probably not more than one, because the complications and the expenses were just too great. So it was a way of defending the home, a way of defending family autonomy, in a new and an altogether new human situation.
One of the things you also point out in your Touchstone article is that we should not assume that just because the Republican Party today at least manages to portray itself as the most pro-family party, that was always the case.
Indeed, it wasn't. I would say, in fact, I argue in the piece and another book titled The American Way, much more extensively, that the pro-family party in America, from about 1915 until 1965, the pro-family party was the Democratic Party. It was the party in favor of small business as opposed to the big corporations. It was the party that opposed feminism, whereas the Republican Party was very closely allied to the feminist movement of the time, which was then called the National Woman's Party. For example, when the National Woman's Party, radical feminists, you know, pure gender egalitarianism, when they crafted their Equal Rights Amendment, their proposed amendment in 1923, it was introduced in both houses of the U.S. Congress by the Republicans. The first organization to endorse it was the National Association of Manufacturers. Why? They wanted to expand the labor pool so they didn't have to pay workers so much. And if they could get mothers and women into the factories, wages that they had to pay would go down just because there'd be almost twice as many potential workers. And they wanted lower wages. So there was a natural relationship between this feminist movement built around the National Woman's Party and the Republican Party, which was also the party of big business. Meanwhile, the Democrats, which represented small farming interests in the Midwest and the South, the old Southern agrarian movement was tied to the Democratic Party. Again, a general tendency to favor small property and small businesses over large corporations in terms of laying out laws. The maternalist movement also rose up. Now, some of its early leaders were, in fact, coming out of Republican homes, I guess you'd say. These were women, primarily, who believed in political and legal equality for women, but believed that men and women were fundamentally different on some key points, namely relative to the birth and nurture of children, and that the law needed to protect women and give them, in fact, special privileges and special protections because women were the mothers of now or in the future, and they deserve special protection. So the maternalist movement created everything from the homemakers movement and the 4-H movement back in the 1917 to the creation of Mother's Day, to the passage of the Shepard-Tonner Act in 1921, which provided government federal assistance for baby saving, they called it, money to protect mothers and to protect infants and reduce their death rates, saving babies and saving mothers. And even the New Deal in the 1930s embodied this same principle of protecting motherhood, encouraging stay-at-home mothers, fiercely opposing daycare, encouraging a wage and other benefits that would help a father maintain a family at home.
We're talking with Dr. Alan Carlson, president of the Howard Center in Rockford, Illinois, about the future of marriage and family in the United States, talking a bit about the past before we move on to the future. One of the things that I find intriguing is, and I want to come back to the whole issue of social engineering that you raise in your favorably in your article in just a moment, but it seems a good time to talk about the decline in the size of the family. I mentioned in my open that the family I grew up in, five children with two parents, is considered large now, but 100 years ago would have been considered at the very best medium size, perhaps even on the small side. When did this change take place, and why?
Well, looking at American history, it's a little different in other places, but in American history, from about the time of the Revolution until about 1825, 1830, family size in America was quite large. We were dealing with mainly an agrarian population, where, in fact, children were welcome on the farm as little workers. And so the average family size at that time was quite high, again, over seven children per family, somewhere which is just about what you get in what they call natural fertility, seven to eight to children per family. It started to decline about 1825, and it declined steadily, slowly at first, but then accelerating by the end of the 19th century, until about 1935. And at that point, the average number of children born per woman reached about two, down from about eight down to about two. Again, I think the main explanations, partly, again, the industrialization process, which, again, separated workplace and home life, tied to that, too, with the rise of modern state schools. And there's very good evidence, John Caldwell, an Australian demographer, has done the best work on this, very good evidence showing that mass state schooling drives fertility down, basically by undermining the relationship between parents and children.
I'm intrigued by that. Does that mean that taking children's education out of the home had an indirect effect in reducing the number of children that fathers and mothers were willing to have?
Well, I don't know if you call it indirect or direct. It's a very strong correlation, as they say in social science. That is, the one caused the other. And it seems to be because the authority structure of the family was undermined once the state became the primary teacher of children. The state had its own agenda, had its own set of governments, had its own agenda, their own set of priorities, their own values to translate. And again, our contemporary battles today over, say, prayer in public schools, or whether Christmas songs could be sung at a school pageant, or what are parents' rights relative to public schools. These are old battles, and ever from the very beginning, I think it's quite clear, government-funded, government-guided education had as part of its agenda, sometimes obvious, sometimes latent, weakening of the family and a weakening of parental authority. It had to have that. I mean, its whole point was to take the children away from the family and to mold them into the citizens of the state. And that's been the objective since the 1830s.
You write, social engineering can be done the right way, that is, in a way that supports the family and helps it flourish. Tell us about what you call these earlier family-building experiments that actually did succeed.
It did succeed for a while. Let me give you one very specific example. The 4-H movement, which was created by the Smith-Lever Extension Act of 1914, was designed to encourage, again, in rural areas in particular, the kind of family I just described, a breadwinning father, a homemaking mother, and a big family. Let me just quickly just pass on from the 1928 4-H songbook. This, again, was a federally subsidized thing here. This is how the federal government tried to engineer education in 1928. This was a song called Dreaming for the Girls. My home must have its mother, may I grow sweet and wise. My home must have its father, with honor in his eyes. My home must have its children, God grant the parents grace, to keep our home through all the years a kindly, happy place. That's federally engineered education in the 1920s. A far cry from what we get today. Also tied to that, again, the New Deal policies of the 1930s, such as the Social Security system, which at that time was designed, again, to reinforce a family wage, to give social insurance to fathers in their roles as fathers and husbands. The grand mobilization of capital to purchase homes for young families during and after World War II through the VA and FHA, federal mortgage insurance programs. Tax policy crafted in the 1940s that favored marriage and children. All of this is what caused this really unusual thing to happen called the baby boom in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Again, this reversed 100 years of American demographic history. Fertility not only stopped declining, it rose. In fact, rose dramatically. It doubled in a matter of about 15 years. And the marriage rate rose dramatically. Just about every adult by 1960, every marriageable person almost was married, the highest rate, the highest proportion of married people among all adults in American history. It was reached about 1960.
So what happened?
Well, the system worked, but it was fragile. And part of the problem is people didn't really understand what made it work and how fragile it was. There was a lot of sort of self-congratulations going on in the 1960s. Our country is strong and viable. The birth rate is high. Our families are strong. But no one was not aware just how fragile this system was and how easily it could be torn down. For example, a key pillar of it was destroyed in 1964, and hardly anybody was aware of it at the time. This was when the Civil Rights Act of 64 was being debated. Title VII dealt with economic questions. And the original thrust of the bill, in fact, is written by the White House, was to protect the job rights of, particularly of African-American men. That was the purpose. The language is a little more vague than that. It had to be for legal reasons, but that was the purpose. And Title VII would protect, and in fact, the idea was to help black men get better jobs so they could become breadwinners and marry homemaking wives and have children in the suburbs. That was the whole point of Title VII. But while it was being considered, a strange coalition of Southern segregationists who wanted to kill the bill joined up with Republican feminists. The women in Congress at the time tended to be Republican and they tended to be feminists, to amend Title VII to include sex among prohibited discriminations. And without ever holding a hearing on what they were doing or knowing why, Congress stumbled into passing that measure. And within a matter of 10 years, the whole American family wage system was undone by that simple change. And again, hardly anyone was aware at the time what they had done. The central pillar of the American social economic system was thrown out, and families have suffered ever since.
Finally, Dr. Carlson, with only about a minute and a half before we have to go, you say that America is an exception to the pattern in the rest of the West when it comes to these issues surrounding the family. How so, and what does that mean?
Well, one example of the American exception was the baby boom and marriage boom that I just described. That only happened in one or two other places, Australia being the principal other example. It didn't happen in Canada. It didn't really happen anywhere in Europe. So that showed American exceptionalism. We also see it today in other developments. American fertility fell sharply between 1965 and 1976. In fact, it led the world in fall, but then it started going up again, slowly at first, but then increasingly. And why? Partly because Americans remain a religious people compared to the rest of the world. Still, on any given Sunday, somewhere around 45% of Americans will be in church or synagogue on any given weekend. That compares to, say, about 10% over in Europe. And religious people, by and large, tend to make a greater commitment to families. There's a correlation between religious commitment and family creation and an openness to children. You also see things like the homeschooling movement in recent decades. A total surprise. Came out of nowhere. But homeschooling families are larger families. And again, another sign of an American ability to come up with, despite our problems, come up with new solutions.
Profam.org is the website for the Howard Center in Rockford, Illinois. Profam, P-R-O-F-A-M.org. It's Family, Religion, and Society, profam.org. Dr. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center in Rockford, Illinois. He's author of several books, including Fractured Generations, Crafting a Family Policy for 21st Century America. And he's also written an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled The Family Factors. Thank you very much for being our guest, Dr. Carlson.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
When we come back from this break, we've got the second part of this first hour. We're going to spend better part of it with Susan Klein of Missouri Right to Life in Jeff City. We're going to look ahead to 2006, and we're going to talk about pro-life legislation in Missouri. Well, Missouri is a leader among the states in pro-life legislation. What does 2006 hold? And we'll also hear some audio as the torch is passed from older Schuler to younger.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc. The movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe continues to score big at the box office. But what do we know about the author of The Chronicles of Narnia? How did C.S. Lewis's formative years help create this great writer, thinker, and educator? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for January is Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. This new book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or find out more about Irrigating Deserts on our website, issuesetc.org. What can modern education learn from the educational philosophy of C.S. Lewis? How important is it to shape both head and heart? Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education by Dr. Joel Heck. The cost is $22.99. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Irrigating Deserts, our Issues Etc. book of the month for January.
You've heard about working smart and not just hard. This Global Minute invites you to pray for Christians to work more strategically. Most of the people who've never heard about Jesus Christ live in Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa. Meanwhile, churches in the United States invest 95% of their money in domestic needs. Estimates show that about 4.5% of money spent on missions is given to reach people who already have a church in their culture. Only 0.5% of mission funds is targeted for Christians who work and live among unreached people. Pray for Christians to work more strategically and resourcefully so more people will hear about Christ for the first time. Also, pray especially for Christian leaders in the United States and Canada to have a passionate vision for reaching the unreached. Here's a missions resource for you and your church. It's missionvisionnetwork.org, missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Some Eastern Europeans write the letter CMB on the door of their homes on Epiphany, January 6th. Some say CMB stands for Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar, the traditional names of the wise men. But Wally Bronner of Frankenmuth, Michigan, has researched the letters and says CMB stands for Christus Mansem Benedicat, May Christ Bless This Home. Here's a story of two homes blessed through adversity. When Eric and Jennifer Bartle's home burned, Mrs. Bartle said, "It was absolutely a blessing. If it takes our house catching on fire so Steve can get a second chance on life, we are fine with that." Steve is Stephen Cook, a 42-year-old man in ill health. In rushing to help his neighbors, he dislodged a blood clot that caused a heart attack. Had it not happened that way, doctors conjecture the blood clot would have remained undiscovered until a fatal heart attack occurred. "How can you see blessings in adversity?" said Mr. Cook. "I pay attention to everything, every flower, every beautiful day, every rainy day, every time a kid is smiling, every time a kid is hurt or not happy. I pay attention to those things because I know everything means something, and what you do notice matters." God moves in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. CMB, May Christ Bless Your Home.
AM 850 KFUO will present a special live broadcast this Sunday from the chapel at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. It will be an Epiphany celebration, and the broadcast begins at 3 p.m. An extraordinary collection of vocal and instrumental groups has been assembled for this special service. You're invited to attend or tune in for this Epiphany celebration this Sunday at 3 p.m. live on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Susan Klein joins us. We're going to talk about stay in Missouri for a little while. We'll get to Illinois later in the program. But as promised, we're going to talk about 2006 pro-life legislation in the state of Missouri. And then tomorrow, God willing, we're going to be talking on the national stage about what may stand there. That's kind of an odd situation because we were talking earlier with Congressman John Shimkus. I think it was last week. No, not last week. It was before last week. Sometime back before vacation. And I asked about pro-life legislation in Washington, and he said, "Well, it's an election year, so don't hold your breath," in essence. Well, what's going to come up in Missouri? We'll talk about that in just a minute with Susan Klein, legislative liaison for Missouri Right to Life. After our short conversation with Susan, we're going to play a little bit of audio from both Robert Shuler Sr. and Robert Shuler Jr. The torch was passed on Sunday between the two. Now Robert Shuler Jr. is the second senior pastor of the Crystal Cathedral. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. Susan Klein, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. I'm glad to be here.
What is the big item for 2006, if there is one, on the agenda legislatively for Missouri?
Well, Todd, we kind of have the same problem here. I mean, it is an election year, but we have quite a few things on the legislative plate for this year. Obviously, our big focus for 2006 will be defeating the initiative petition that will go on the November 2006 ballot if the pro-cloners can get all of the signatures that they need. So we will continue to fight that battle all the way through the legislative session. I know there's been some reports about legislators should come out in support of that initiative petition. Obviously, we recommend that pro-life legislators really take a look and take the pro-life position, which is to oppose that initiative petition. So we continue to stress to our legislators that they need to pass a ban on human cloning and send a message to the general public that this initiative petition is bad, and the best way they can do that is to pass a ban on human cloning in the legislature. We obviously will also be working on legislation to recognize and educate about the unborn child feeling pain during an abortion. We're looking at another piece of legislation that we've worked on for years to prevent state funding of abortions. We obviously want to deal with the issue also of the pharmacy conscience clause, the pharmacist's rights to, you know, refuse to fill abortifacients, abortion-causing drugs. And then we also are looking at legislation for tax credits for crisis pregnancy centers. And then there's three more. There's a variety of all of these, but there's a funding bill for umbilical cord blood bank, which also gets into the stem cell issue, but it is dealing with adult stem cells, the good form of stem cells that are out there actually creating and cures and therapies for diseases. And then there's a piece of legislation about that you cannot withhold nutrition at the end of someone's life. And then there's another piece of legislation that deals with if a girl under the age of 14 goes in for an abortion, that clinic must report a rape. So we have a variety of issues that obviously we may or may not get to deal with all of them, but they're all very important issues.
I want to kind of take them in the order that you gave them to us. First of all, what is the best argument, because these ads have been playing, you know what I'm talking about in Missouri,
yeah,
that blur the lines as much as they can be blurred, and they're running in high rotation in Missouri in favor of this November initiative if they get enough signatures? What's the best argument against the initiative that touts itself as both a ban on cloning, which it isn't, and also as the promise for great cures in the future? What's the best argument?
The best argument is that the proposed initiative actually changes the definition of what human cloning is. It deceives the general public, and it says that somatic cell nuclear transfer is not human cloning, which if you look in all of the biology textbooks and the biology terminology and definitions, somatic cell nuclear transfer is human cloning. And so they redefine human cloning in order to say that they're trying to ban human cloning. And they actually then begin life beginning at implantation rather than at conception, which is, you know, it has always been our basis in the abortion battle. Science has taken us beyond that, and now we have to recognize that science can create human life. And now our platform is life begins at inception, and we have to make sure that they don't get into the business of creating human life specifically for the purpose of it becoming a product, that embryo is a human being. And there is no reason for them to be doing this research. There's no reason for them to put this into our Missouri state constitution. It guarantees that we will have human cloning in the state of Missouri. They can find therapies and cures for diseases, which is already being shown in adult stem cell research. So there's no reason to go down this path.
Jumping ahead to the one that's related to that, funding, Missouri state funding, I assume, for umbilical cord, an umbilical cord blood bank. You said that's tied into the stem cell issue. How so?
Well, we're trying to fund, and a bill was passed last year. Senator Bartle passed a bill, and the governor signed it, that we could fund adult. It gave us our mechanism to go ahead and fund good adult stem cell research, which umbilical cord blood is adult stem cells. And that, once again, is one of the best places that they are finding those therapies, is through umbilical cord blood cells and our nasal passages. So we're trying to get funding to find cures and therapies without killing a human being in the process of doing that.
Susan, you mentioned this clause of conscience for Missouri state pharmacists. Why is that important?
Well, once again, it kind of gets back into the same issue of when does life begin? And this is going to become an issue in the court cases coming up January the 19th, where the Missouri Baptist Convention and the Catholic Church and Missourians Against Human Cloning have filed a lawsuit because this language on the ballot regarding the initiative petition deceives the general public. But it gets into the issue of if a pharmacist is not going to fill a prescription, at what point does life begin? The petition is going to deal deal with that. The pharmacy conscience clause is going to deal with that. If we say that life begins at implantation, then we're going to have a problem with our pharmacists we already know from science that an abortifacient kills that or stops that embryo from implanting. So, and if we say that life begins at conception, then we need to give the pharmacist, and the pharmacist knows the science of this, then we need to give them an out so that they do not prescribe a drug that they know is going to kill that human embryo. So it's important, obviously, from the perspective of what's happened in Illinois, where the pharmacists have been, told that they can't refuse to fill those, abortion-related drugs.
I mean, given the fact that Illinois, we've talked with one of the pharmacists who was dismissed from Walgreens over that whole issue on the program several times, and one of the issues he's pointed out is that even though Illinois does have a right of conscience for pharmacists like they do for doctors, it didn't do them much good. Would the proposed legislation in Missouri try and rectify that, what appears to be a deficiency in the Illinois case?
Right. Every time that we have worked on a piece of pro-life legislation, we always take and learn from what is happening and what has been, presented in court cases in other states. So obviously we're going to take into recognition or acknowledge and review anything that's happened in Illinois and see, make sure that our language at least addresses those loopholes.
All right. You talked about tax credits for crisis pregnancy centers. What does that look like? What are the particulars of that?
There has been money that, and this piece of legislation has been out there for several years, that actually was part of a piece of legislation last year, Senate Bill 2, where there is extra funds that is, that can go to give tax credits to those that donate to crisis pregnancy centers. So it's a complicated piece of legislation as far as explaining how those funds get to. It's usually not money directly out of the budget. It is usually looking at it from other perspective.
And one of the things that was, of course, brought to the national fore, and that is the withholding of nutrition at the end of life, or I would assume this also includes people in the case of Terry Schiavo, who's nowhere near the end of her life. What does the proposed Missouri legislation look like in that case?
Well, actually, this piece of legislation was out there last year also because of the Terry Schiavo situation. We just want to make sure that a person in that situation their nutrition is not withdrawn from them.
Here's the intriguing one. When you mentioned it, I have never heard of this before. A girl appearing at a clinic for an abortion will be considered legally the victim of statutory rape, and it must be reported as a crime. What chances do you think that has?
We've had an abortion statistic reporting bill out there for several years, and we don't have specifics, and I'm not talking about a person's name or anything like that. We don't have specifics about how the abortions are done. This issue came up whenever we were working on the ban on partial birth abortion. We need to know specifically the abortions and maybe the ages of the girls. I mean, there's a lot of information without getting into knowing the person, so that the legislature can deal with legislation that would make sure that a minor girl is not in an abusive situation with this abortion clinic. So we're just looking, it's more abortion statistic reporting, which allows us then to get into if somebody has raped a minor girl, then there needs to be accountability there for that.
All of these things that we've mentioned here in our conversation, which do you think has the best chance, or do these really have a reasonable chance in 2006, given the fact it's an election year?
I think we have a good chance of looking at something to do with the pharmacy conscience clause, as well as the crisis pregnancy center tax credits. Now, once again, like I said at the beginning, this is an election year, so we just kind of have to look at these bills and all of these issues and see how they move through the process.
Finally, give us a breakdown on where the Missouri House and the Missouri Senate stand on life issues.
Right now with abortion legislation, we should not have any problem passing legislation through the House and the Senate. Now, obviously, that getting back to the the stem cell issue with somatic cell nuclear transfer versus the embryonic stem cells versus the adult stem cells, we're not likely to see any movement this year. And I know a lot of pro-lifers are very discouraged about that because they worked very hard. We knew this issue was coming. This issue has been in the works ever since the tobacco settlement money became an issue back in 98, 99, 2000. So the issue has been there for a while, and it has been discussed in elections. So as far as abortion legislation, I think we'll see something move there. Fighting the ban on human cloning, I think we're stalled until after we see what happens in the November 2006 election.
Do you believe that those pushing for that initiative are going to get the signatures they need?
We are going to challenge it every step of the way. I don't believe they'll have a problem getting 145,000. I think they will have a problem passing it in the state of Missouri, because Missouri is a very pro-life state. And we're not, and pro-life does not mean just pro-life on abortion. Pro-life is pro-life. Otherwise, if you're just opposed to abortion, you are just anti-abortion. But you cannot call yourself pro-life, because pro-life protects life on every front, whether it's the beginning of life, the creation of life, or the destruction of life in an end-of-life decision. So, I think they're going to have a problem passing it, because the general public in the state of Missouri is very, very pro-life, and pro-life is pro-life on every issue.
Folks, you can stay informed on pro-life legislation in the state of Missouri for 2006 at missourilife.org. MissouriLife.org, that's the website for Missouri Right to Life, based in Jefferson City. Susan Klein is legislative liaison for Missouri Right to Life. Thank you for being our guest, Susan.
Thank you, Todd.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. This is, we've done things on education before. We've done a lot of shows on education, but never have we gone back to an educator, the likes of this, to mine their wisdom about education today. C.S. Lewis is known for many things, but he was also an educator. The book is called Irrigating Desert, C.S. Lewis on Education. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. It's $22.99 plus shipping and handling, and you can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number is 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also find the book at our website. Just go to issuesetc.org. And there on the homepage, you'll find Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. Well, in the time left to us here, we've got a little bit of audio to play. Here's the AP story. Schuller's son to take over at Crystal Cathedral. The Reverend Robert Schuller is stepping down as senior pastor of the Crystal Cathedral, which he founded 50 years ago. The 79-year-old Schuller told worshipers in his all-glass church southeast of Los Angeles that he'll be replaced on January 22nd by his 51-year-old son, the Reverend Robert A. Schuller. We could call him Robert Schuller Jr. First, let's hear from Robert Schuller Sr. He says the church's board has picked his son to succeed him.
They nominated and voted unanimously to elect Robert Anthony as the second senior pastor of this church.
Now, this is a big move. Robert Schuller built the church, well, to speak in his terms, built the church from the ground up. The story is an old one. In the mid-80s, he travels out to California, nothing in his pockets, nothing but a pretty decent theological education from the Dutch Reformed standpoint. He goes out there and he decides he's going to build a church like no other. He goes door to door. This is his own story. He goes door to door and he asks people that he meets there, what do you want in a church? He started the first drive-in church. Did you know that? He had a drive-in church out there. It eventually grew and grew and grew, and eventually, I think in 1986, they dedicated the Crystal Cathedral, and they've continued to expand that church ever since. Well-known through the Hour of Power broadcast, well, the senior Schuller also says that his son is going to take that over as well.
I'm promising not to meddle. He's nervous about that. But we've been a great father-son team. We have a great deal of respect for each other.
Now, we've reviewed the sermons of both the elder Schuller and the younger Schuller in our sermon reviews. And in fact, a little bit later in today's program, in the last hour, we're going to be listening to this sermon in which there's a passing of the torch from the elder Schuller to the younger Schuller. It was from this Sunday. The message, Jeff and I had a little bit of a conversation about this before we came on the air. The message, to me, seems to have shifted a little bit between the two. Robert Schuller is very much about possibility thinking, very much about positive thinking, although he doesn't use that term so much anymore. It's possibility thinking. If it's going to be, it's up to me. He has all of his little catchphrases, and he's famous for putting all of these into his books over and over again. We've interviewed him on the program, and in the course of that interview, that was what you heard from him. You don't hear that language so much from his son when he preaches. It is the same message, for what it's worth. But the catchphrases aren't there. And I'm wondering about that shift. Now, I'd love to hear from our Robert Schuller fans. I know you're out there. Who do you prefer, Robert Schuller Sr. or his son, Robert Schuller Jr.? What do you think of shifting where more and more you'll see less and less of the gray-haired Schuller? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you think the hour of power will be the same without the face, the voice, and those catchy phrases from Robert Schuller? Do you think it will continue to build upon its past success? That's the big question. You know, we talked with Kim Riddlebarger not too long back on this program, and we did the theology of Robert Schuller. And he was adamant about it. He said, look, he's been very influential, but his influence is gone now. He is waning. In the waning days of his influence and of his popularity, Robert Schuller is. So can that popularity be regained by his son? Well, Robert Schuller Sr., founding pastor of the Crystal Cathedral, says that he and his son will continue to preach for the time being, even though he's stepping down as senior pastor. They'll continue to preach together.
Not every Sunday, but most Sundays will be pastoral teaching up here like we've been.
Now, look, he's 79 years old. Most people are not still doing their job at 79. Most people are not as active as this man is. Let's give that much to him. And most pastors, most, are not in the pulpit as often as he is at 79 years old. I mean, he's doing good for 79. The son, he's got another two decades in him if he lives to be as spry and lives as long as his dad does. Do you expect that 20 years from now, the younger Schuller will have built the kind of career influence that his father has? It's a bit of a dynasty, isn't it? Or is it just a dynasty that lasts one generation and you can pass it on to the son? I mean, look at John Osteen. And then his son, Joel. I mean, John was big business. He was the big thing. He was a regular on TBN. He wasn't the brightest light, but he was bright. And he did some things. He had a stellar career as far as worldly success goes. But in comes Joel, and you haven't seen anything yet. You think that the younger Robert Schuller has that kind of potential? So what does Robert Schuller Jr. think about his promotion?
I cannot do it alone, but together we can make a great team and we can launch this ministry into its next phase of growth and potential together.
Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Just listening to some of the AP audio from the passing of the torch from Robert Schuller Sr. to Robert Schuller Jr., Robert Schuller Sr. stepping down as senior pastor of the Crystal Cathedral in Garden Grove, California, and his son taking the mantle as the second senior pastor of that church. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here finally, Robert Schuller Jr., he's the incoming senior pastor of the Crystal Cathedral, says he hopes the congregation will be praying for him.
I accept the challenge
how with excitement, and I accept the opportunity to be able to lead this church into the decades ahead.
Okay, here are my thoughts on this. This is pure opinion. I think it's a well-informed opinion. But having watched the trends of the big churches, the mega churches, and the churches that are so much in the media and in the influence for the last, you know, better part of a decade, unless something really changes, I do not see the second Robert Schuller repeating the success of his dad. I think the show will still be there, but I think it will probably dwindle over time. My gut reaction is I give it 10 years. I give it 10 years. I don't wish them ill. I profoundly disagree with the message they preach. We'll talk about that when we review the sermon coming up. But when you've got Joel Osteen, I mean, even the Willow Creeks and the Saddlebacks are, well, not so much Saddleback, but the Willow Creeks are waning in their influence. We have a conversation coming up in a couple of weeks here on Issues, Etc. with David Wells. And he says in the last couple of years, Willow Creek has begun to hear the death knell. That's what he talks about, the death knell of that they are passé. So if Willow Creek is passe, and still many people are flocking there, what of the Crystal Cathedral? We're kind of watching the dinosaurs slowly march into the tar pits. Or are we? I could be wrong on this. I could, but big Mormon tabernacle choir-like choirs, beautiful vistas of smiling faces in a Crystal Cathedral, Geneva gowns and Medals of Honor. I don't know what it is Robert Schuller wears. He wears some sort of big medal, Presidential Medal of Honor or something. And then the kind of feel good, you can, if you believe, dream and make it true. In the days of Norman Vincent Peale and his popularity, mid-70s, that was the thing. I just don't see it lasting much longer, unless, of course, the sun decides to take a different path. When we come back from this break, Pastor Matt Harrison joins us in the second hour of the program. We'll get a year beginning and year end review after a year where one of the biggest stories from its very beginning, right before the new year, was the tsunami that killed so many and destroyed the lives of so many others. Pastor Matt Harrison will join us to talk about tsunami relief. We'll also be hearing a little bit from the PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly program. They have a roundtable looking forward to 2006 and the big issues. That's coming up next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.